Oh, Mares, how are you?
I'm doing quite well and excited to be with you. How's it going?
Well, it's better now that I hear that sound. I heard the tube.
Oh, that wonderful, wonderful sound.
We're going to come back to it, and I'm super excited to hear it. We actually, as we sort of mentioned on our last episode, we jumped around a little bit. We paused. This episode was actually going to record before our last one.
Right.
And then we looked at our calendars. Yes. And can we just talk about, oh, Barbara, just for just 1 second before we dig in.
I'm telling you, some of the feedback that we're getting is very interesting. How successful she was, yet how few people knew who she was. She really had a time and a place. And just the advice that she distributed freely, but did not live herself.
Freely. Very freely.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I found interesting? We've had feedback from several listeners about this episode, and it's striking me, listeners who say they don't read romance novels, they have no interest in romance novels, but wow, they are interested in Barbara. Right. And she is. She's that kind of person we love to find on this podcast. What a Valentine's Day gift she was, Maris.
You know, if you want to think of like London as just being this mixed bowl, this mixed fruit salad, you're going to have the visionaries, you're going to have the heroes, and you're going to have the eccentrics. You're going to have a little bit of everything. And
I'd argue that Barbara might be the cherry on top of that London fruit salad.
She thought so, for sure.
And cover that cherry in shoe polish.
It'll protect everything, I think. So, yeah, and I just think it's interesting to, how fascinating to live the same length as a century. That's just very valuable, perspective.
Mares, it was handy for our podcast. I could keep track of her age and everything so well. I appreciated that.
You know what? You gotta, even if you don't care for Barbara, you gotta give something to someone who reaches her prime as an octogenarian.
Yes, I agree.
Kudos to you, Barbs.
Cheers to you, Barbs. Well, you were talking about that fruit salad of London and about the mosaic or quilt that London is. And, you know, we are all about inquiry and questions and stories on this podcast, particularly stories that are new to us or perhaps that were familiar to us before, but then we dig a little more deeply to try to discover people, places, and facets of history that are maybe lesser known, quirkier, as you said, or even downright strange. We love it. We also really like to shine a spotlight on those who really do or have done amazing things, but maybe have been forgotten over time or lost in the shuffle of a typical news cycle or a history text. And we love finding stories of people who contribute to the collective good.
The best.
In some way, yes. That goes all the way back to our very first episode, Always Look for the Helpers, when we highlighted Albert Gunter and Dr. Joan Martin.
I remember it well.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't even plan that. We both wrote a mini story, and we realized both at the center of both of our stories were these people who helped during a tragic situation. Another thing that's brought you and I together over the years, Mares, as friends and business partners and podcasters, was obviously our love for London and its history and its people and just its diversity, its food, the entertainment. We were just talking about that before we recorded.
Yeah.
You know, even its flaws, just the heartbeat of this amazing place that's like a second home to us. We've mentioned on the podcast before, but something that we immediately recognized as a commonality of our collective London experiences was that love of the underground or the tube. Mm-hmm. And we quickly realized that when it comes to the tube, we just get it.
Yeah.
So what's there to get about the tube? I mean, it's an underground train, right? At its most basic level, yes. That's what it is. But if you know London, you know it's something more. Love it or hate it, and there's people on both sides of that fence, it's so much more than just transportation between our feet. It supplies life to the city. It literally has 5 million passenger journeys on any given day. 5 million. It's the veins and arteries that allow all the movement that keeps the city going and makes it such a special place. The tube itself is special. I know we've mentioned this before on the show, but for the sake of this episode, it is the oldest transportation system of its kind in the world. It opened on the 10th of January, 1863. Today, it's expanded to 408 kilometers of active rail. That's about 253 miles. And it's evolved from steam engines to the live electric rails that we know today. It has 11 different lines that combine to host 272 stations. There are thousands of books written about the history of the underground, its ghosts, its mysteries, and the people who brought it to fruition. It's been the subject of countless documentaries and even a reality show. There are train spotting clubs and enthusiast groups worldwide. There's people who know its every detail down to the number of the rolling stock on the trains.
Yes.
Speaking of the lines, we said there was 11 lines. Do you have a favorite line, Maris? I know a lot of people do, but wait, I want to see if I can guess yours, if you do.
I bet you won't guess mine.
Okay. I'm not. Well, that's a little bit of a clue in itself. Okay, I'm going to guess that your favorite is the circle line.
Oh, what an interesting guess. But no, I mean, I guess you can think about the one that you like to ride. I'm being more nostalgic. It's just certain places that I like to go.
You can pick more than one because I have three, essentially. So you can pick more than one.
I think my line, though, is the Piccadilly. Hmm. It gets me where I want to go. It's a good, solid Bloomsbury line.
It is.
You know. You can even go all the way to Heathrow if you need to.
Absolutely. It's hard to have a day where you don't cross onto the Piccadilly line at some point.
And come on, it's terminal, you know, it's Eastern Terminal is Cockfosters, so there's that too.
There's that. I think, although, doesn't the Circle Line go through Cockfosters as well? You could, you know, there we go. Yeah. I was thinking the Circle Line because it is right there in the heart.
Sure.
And that's what I was thinking about, too.
And that's a lovely... you know, city nostalgic. I was talking about my personal experience there and some happy years that I had when I was quite young.
Yes.
And so, yeah, just knowing all the stops by heart and that kind of thing is that very comforting. Although, you know, we've talked about our time in London as students and how much we love to experiment with the rails. So.
Yes, yes. My personal favorites, I've got three all for different reasons.
Yeah.
My favorite nighttime line is the Northern Line. Love the Northern Line, going to Camden Town.
Right.
There's something gritty about the Northern Line. The Northern Line is always interesting, especially at night. There's always characters and stories from the Northern Line.
A lot of singing.
I sentimentally, the way you feel about the Piccadilly, I feel about the Bakerloo.
Yeah.
And I love the color of the moquette on the Bakerloo.
I
love the orange and gold and browns.
That brown,
My flat when I was a student was on the Bakerloo. Mm-hmm. So
what was your stop?
Warwick Avenue.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Very near Maida Vale.
Duffy and you and Duffy.
Yes, yes. And I also love the Jubilee line. The Jubilee line is, I love how deep it goes.
Yeah.
It's noisy as all get out, the train itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just another one of those lines. I've had some really great journeys to different places, out to Wembley on the Jubilee, to St. John's Wood,
and like that
all
came
kinds
around
of places.
Like maybe the 70s, right? Something
it's
like
a
that.
Newer
Newish.
Line.
So that's,
newish.
That's always impressive to me that in a very modern city, that kind of work that would need to be done to make something new.
Yes, absolutely.
So I always think of the Jubilee as that, like in a modern city, like we're just going to bust through and make this more convenient.
Well, it's such the antithesis of those super old lines like the Circle District, Metropolitan and City, those kind of lines. And I love how deep it goes. And the Northern Line, I think it actually has the deepest tunnels, but the Jubilee just feels very deep to me. I don't know why.
I do know which tube line or which tube stop has the longest escalator. Do you know that?
I just saw this.
It's on the Northern.
I just saw this. I literally just saw this the other day. And I can't remember.
It's Angel.
Angel.
And I was on the Angel one day, and I'm just thinking, like, you know how you're thinking about your day, and I'm going to stop here, and I need to go over there. And then I just think to myself, like, God, I've been on this escalator forever. What's going on? So I Google it, and it's like, yes, this is the longest escalator. I just realized, like, I planned my whole day. I'm still writing, like, still, like, halfway up.
Angel is the Michael Sheen stop to me now because of Good Omens.
Oh, yeah,
so
of course.
It's a zero fail. That's that stop now. You know, we both mentioned it now is when we first met. We talked about that mutual love so much. And as COVID set in and we were all housebound, we spent a lot of time reminiscing about our favorite journeys and things. And also the pastime that we share, which you alluded to a little bit ago, which is hopping on the tube and picking a random station somewhere on the line to visit. Somewhere that is perhaps new to us, or maybe just a place that we've yet to really explore or we've just passed through in the past. I know I did this myself within just a few days of being in London for the first time. As I had mentioned, when I was a student, my flat was nearest Warwick Avenue, which was on the Bakerloo. And the southernmost terminus of the Bakerloo is a station called Elephant and Castle. And as I would sit on the tube after class in those early days, I would stare at the map of the underground that's on the side of the car, trying to familiarize myself with it. Because basically, I was trying to understand the workings of the map so that I could navigate my way around the stations, if not like a local, but at least like someone who wasn't a total newbie or fresh tourist. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Everybody's welcome on the tube, as long as you stand on the right side of the escalator.
Thank you.
That's non-negotiable, and you learn very quickly if you're just standing on the left. Don't do that, listeners. Walk on the left, stand on the right. So anyway, I would stare at that map, and Elephant and Castle just always caught my eye. It was basically the total opposite end of the map of the line from my flat, and I just suppose I found the name interesting. So one day I got on the tube after class, and instead of transferring to the northbound Bakerloo platform, and this was at Piccadilly, by the way, I went to the southbound Bakerloo platform instead, and it was about 3 in the afternoon, and just a lovely day, just beautiful, beautiful London afternoon. And you know what that means. Mm-hmm. People were out and about, and pub culture was at its London finest. You know what I'm talking about.
Definitely.
Can you describe it for our listeners? Just that lovely after work pub
day.
Vibe on a
yes.
beautiful day in the city. Just bring our listeners into that world. What's it like?
Yeah. So I'm picturing a lot of people in their work clothes, you know, so you've maybe mm-hmm. taken off your jacket, but you've still got your, you know, your work shirt.
Yeah, and loosened work clothes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Loosened work clothes, standing deep, 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 deep to the bar. In fact, if you're not going to the pub, you may actually have to throw yourself into traffic to get around.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It spills out onto the sidewalks.
Yes. And like, who's going to get the drinks? Like, who's your pick of your party? Like, somebody's mm-hmm. going to go and take orders and head out. Music, hilarity, laughter.
Sing-alongs.
Yes. I'm thinking of being in London one of the times that I've been there. And the first night I was out, the guy next to me was telling a story to somebody, and he said, "And Bob's your uncle." And I just thought, here I am.
Once you hear Bob's your uncle, it's all over.
Yeah, here we are.
You're there. Do you have a favorite pub, Maris, or just is it just collectively any pub?
You know, I do have a neighborhood one in Bloomsbury that I mm-hmm. like. It's just very family. I mean, it's not, it's a little off the beaten path. Mm-hmm. It's called the Lord John Russell. Mm-hmm. And that would be my Sunday roast place, personally. Mm-hmm. How about you?
Near Warwick Avenue tube stop and near my flat, there is a pub called The Warrington. It's still there today, The Warrington Arms, and I have a soft spot for it. It's, you know, that's zone 2. You're going to be a little further out, mm-hmm. but it's a great bar on the inside. They pull a wonderful Guinness. And then the outside on the side, they've got a beautiful garden with party lights, and there's a red phone booth right there next to it.
Right.
And it's just beautiful, and tables, and people will play games, and there's darts, and it's wonderful.
Well, when you were saying that too, I was thinking of the like the spillover. So many pubs will have like outdoor like picnic tables. Like
yes, if that's they have what the Warrington space. Has.
Okay, yeah. Same, absolutely. Same with mine and so many others. Mine is not fancy. It's just a local, local place you'd go.
Yeah, the Warrington is not fancy either. Yeah.
There are some that are just so wonderful, you know, architecturally and you know, just the fabrics and colors and history. You could just feel it in the pub, but always a delight.
I also love when you're in within the heart of central London on a Friday. The last time I was there, I had been taking a stroll down Regent Street. So I was in a very busy area and I had gone off onto some side streets and it was one of those lovely pub days and it's a Friday and just pub after pub. And you could, before you rounded a corner, you could tell another one was coming because you could hear the revelry. And it's just so much, it's embedded within London culture, within British culture. You know, a drinking lunch is not uncommon in the United States. Sadly, that's a bit uncommon, and the pub culture is just a little bit different here. But it's so ingrained, and it's such a lovely thing. And the day that I went to Elephant and Castle, it was one of those days, and I don't remember the pub's name. Odds are if I went, I mean, maybe it's been taken over by Wetherspoons or something, I don't know. But it was one of those days, and inside there was, people were throwing darts and playing. I ended up in a dart game. I ended up staying there for about 5 hours. It was wonderful. It had a beautiful garden in the back. People were so friendly. They thought it was hilarious how I ended up there because I explained where I had been and what I had decided to do and that I wanted to go to Elephant and Castle. And they thought that was hilarious.
Perfectly logical choice.
Perfectly logical.
I mean, how could you pass up? I mean, I've wondered that myself. I don't know that I've sought it out, but I've certainly dreamed of what could happen at Elephant and Castle.
I'll tell you, I had a great time. I would go back. 5 stars, would recommend. Right. So, you know, the tube is fun, but it also just serves so many functions. You know, from a practical standpoint, it helps keep cars off the already congested streets. And since there's a fee associated with driving in the city center, in the heart of the center, and that's about to expand, I believe. It's also an economic advantage because the tube is fairly reasonable to take. It's easy, though, to spend money on it because you just go tap your Oyster card, you load it up again and, you know, that kind of thing. It serves such a vast number of destinations that are relatively far from the city center as well.
Yeah.
And it joins London to the rest of the Isle through the overground railways that all connect to it. Like you had said earlier, if you fly into London, it's likely your gateway into central London. And it can't be beat. I've actually, through both major airports coming, I've taken the Gatwick Express to Victoria. And of course, from Heathrow, you get on the Piccadilly line. Everybody uses it. Children, older people, all ages. It really is the great equalizer.
School trips. You know, to museums, you always see the school trips.
Constantly. Public transport in London is just so much more ingrained into everyday life than it is in the United States, for instance. So after all this, what is the central theme for us this year on yesterday's London Times, you ask? Well, Mayors, here's what I think. As we said, we love stories. We love everyday heroes. We also have a great familiarity with the underground. And it's a part of our everyday lives when we're there, just like it is for all the other people who are contributing to its millions of journeys daily. It takes us to the stories, the people, the places, the sites of the events that are a part of the fabric of this city. It's the lifeline. At the same time, we're sitting here from afar, missing London, right? So how about this? Periodically this year, let's do like we are when we're in London, Mayors, and let's bring that to our listeners as well. Let's take some journeys on the tube and see what we find in some random destinations.
Okay.
There's been times in London where I literally close my eyes and run my finger over the iconic map, and wherever it stops, that's where I will journey and explore and learn and have an adventure that day. I've met some amazing people doing this. So here's what I've decided to do for the podcast. I've put every single tube station on a virtual wheel. We've done this before for other ideas with the podcast. And I've spun it for the first time. A station came up, and when it came up, I committed myself to going there.
Okay.
I'm putting that in quotes in this episode. What am I talking about? Well, when the station came up on the wheel, I decided to look the station up, confirm its location in the city, and then research and read about the history of the borough it's in, the neighborhood it serves. I asked myself questions like, who lives here now? Who's lived here in the past? Mm-hmm. What has happened here? What do people of this area have to say? Or perhaps the ghosts of the former inhabitants? What did they say? What are some places to visit? What might I eat? What is quirky or unique? What can I learn from this area of London? The rules I used in my research were very loose, Maris. I simply explored the area virtually, just like I would explore it on foot. But I had the advantage of being able to dig deeply and finding information about some of the things I might see right on the spot. The area I looked at, for every area, when I do this, I'm going to confine myself to the streets for which this tube stop is generally the closest location.
Okay.
Now, we might walk a bit. And when I say walk a bit, you know, a kilometer and a half.
Sure.
A kilometer, which is roughly about a mile.
Right.
So we're talking about a mile radius.
Yeah.
Sort of. You know, obviously closest station is a bit gray because there's so many stations. Sometimes you might go further than your closest station to begin a journey on a, you know, maybe to get on, begin your journey on a different line.
Exactly. Yeah.
To avoid changing trains mid journey, or maybe there's a strike that day.
Yeah, strike, slow down. Yeah,
exactly. A signal failure. But I didn't get picky with all that. I just went with the idea that my boundary would be the streets and businesses and landmarks that would likely utilize this station for the start of their journey for at least a good amount of the time.
I'm so excited.
Okay. So, are you ready to know which station we're going to explore first?
It's not going to be Elephant and Castle.
It's not Elephant and Castle.
Okay. You just randomly. Not. Okay. Yeah.
Let's... And it truly was. I promise you.
Yeah.
I spun it one time.
You.
Only
yeah.
one has been eliminated.
Yeah. Okay.
And that station is Oval.
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 Okay.
But you're going to have to wait just a little bit longer.
Because
I think here would be a good place for a break.
Mm-hmm.
When we come back, I'm hopefully going to tell you some things about this area of London that maybe you've never known before.
I'm in.
So Oval, here we are.
Here we are.
Have you been to Oval?
Not to my knowledge.
I don't think I have either, to be honest. So
where exactly is Oval?
I was going to start out with a few basic facts about Oval Station, so that's perfect. Let's kind of get our bearings and see where we're at.
For sure.
Oval is in South London. So if you're looking at the iconic underground map, which is amazingly user-friendly, but not necessarily geographically accurate,
correct.
It's going to appear to be directly south of Waterloo.
Okay.
On the tube map of Waterloo Station.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the London borough of Lambeth.
Oh, Lambeth. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. In real geography, not tube map geography, it's about 1.6 kilometers or exactly a mile from Charing Cross.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an area that grew very quickly and very densely during the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm.
And in hearing that, you can probably guess why. It was due to industry.
Mm-hmm.
So there were many, because industry was growing and booming in this part, all of a sudden there was many commercial and residential buildings that supported that industry that popped up into this area.
Yeah, I think we were in that neighborhood for the music halls episode. I think there were some pretty big music halls in the Lambeth area.
I do believe, yes, yeah. There's a lot in Lambeth in general. There's a lot going on, more than even just off the top of my head as I was kind of cruising around on my little trip here. It's located in Zone 2, and it is on the Northern Line.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that Northern Line. It is sort of gritty, like that Northern Line, like I talked about. Oval opened on the 18th of December, 1890, and it was originally called Kennington Oval. And it's named after the Oval Cricket Ground, which is still served by the station.
Wow.
Yeah. Eventually, it was just shortened to Oval, and that is its proper name now. It's gone through several remodels. The most recent one was in the late 90s, and this is still accurate for today. And listeners, these pictures are going to be in the show notes. So if you'd like to take a look, I invite you to take a look at the show notes. I'm going to show Mayor's now because I want us to feel like we're just getting off the platform in Oval. So somewhat of a typical station. There's mm-hmm. the platform. It's the iconic roundel. Mm-hmm. You have the adverts on the other side. You can see the way out.
Cylindrical.
Oh, yes. Tube there. Just love the shapes of the station. And there's the other platform.
Great perspective there, yeah.
The Northern Line is the only line that goes through Oval. So there's just the two platforms. Then when you go upstairs, it's kind of cute when you're up in the station. There are tiles and there's pictures of cricketers.
Oh, cricketers, yes. I could see that they were athletes. They're there.
Yes. So they're in sort of green ovals.
Oh, yeah. That's
and then
cute.
You can see the cricketers, and that's obviously an homage to the cricket ground. So when you come outside the station, and listeners, these are, again, follow along in the show notes if you wish. There's the outside of the station, which was also sort of redone in tile. I kind of feel like it sort of looks, I know it was done in the 90s, but it kind of looks like a 1950s corner gas station in the United States.
That's exactly
or
what
or a burger joint right. or something like that. It's got that kind of retro look for something in the United States anyway.
Yeah, it does.
But that's the outside of the station. So that's where we're entering, listeners and mayors. That's what we're coming out of. That's what we're going to see now. But now let's go outside and see what kind of adventures that need to be had. So where shall we go first? The first thing in my head as we exit this station is this. The area below our feet right now has the distinction, or acutely horrible luck, rather, of being a central target of the very first day of the Blitz.
Really?
Yes. So on September, the 7th of September, 1940, that was Black Saturday, and it was the first of the 57 consecutive nights of the Blitz, and even some days. Mm-hmm. Bombings weren't confined to just night. On Black Saturday, German bombers absolutely desecrated the city. 430 people lost their lives, and over 1,600 others were wounded. The assault began late in the afternoon, around 16 or 4 p.m., and the attack lasted for about 12 hours.
Oh, goodness.
Till about 4:30 in the morning. Oval began to be bombarded around 9:30 p.m., and I found this information on a fascinating site that I was lucky enough to stumble upon called ovalhistory.co.uk.
Nice.
And people who have lived in Oval have contributed to it. They've gone through the archives. They've found stories from the streets and all these individual buildings and families. It's just lovely. I'm going to put that link in the show notes.
Thank you to the historians, amateur and professional, all of the heritage associations of different neighborhoods. Thank you so much for gathering that, making it available.
We stand you. It's mm-hmm. it's amazing. And I give this one extra props because they really dug deeply and really whet my appetite for the area. It was one of the first sources that I found as I was researching this. I learned from that site that Southie Road and Caldwell Street were the main targets that night. And what happened as the bombs hit, the main gas line was blown. The roads were completely blown apart. They just no longer existed on those streets. 26 houses were hit on Caldwell Street alone. The Oval History site describes the night as just this picture of chaos and destruction, with firemen and wardens trudging through glass and bricks and timber and all the personal effects and belongings that are strewn everywhere as they're trying to put out the enormous fires that are blazing all around, while simultaneously dealing with the morbid task of digging out the deceased and the wounded. And this is when it's all fresh. It's night one.
Just picturing yourself in the shoes of any Londoner, you know, this is like now we're in it.
Yeah.
But to not know that there are 56 more nights of this consecutively, and then years and years of it too.
And us in retrospect knowing that, it's so sobering, isn't it? And remembering this as we journey through Oval, it sort of helps me to really appreciate exactly what the city was up against, like you said. And the fact that it's here today, despite whatever the odds might have seemed on that horrid night, those streets are back. The homes are there. You know, if you weren't aware or weren't alive then or hadn't read about it, when you come out of Oval Station, you might not know that for any chance. But that's the ground you're standing on. As I'm walking, I might just also think of a man named Fawcett Stanley Lawrence Fraser of nearby Brixton. Or just Stan, as he was known to his friends. Or, if you want to use his legend, Stan the Chicken Worshipper. Stan the Chicken Worshipper comes from this area. Stan was a taxi driver who came to England in the late 40s, just after the war, from, according to a Daily Mirror article on the 23rd of November, 1953, also comments of the Oval History site, from the, quote, jungles of South America. The article goes on to tell us that Stan kneels every day to pray to his cockerel. Stan doesn't eat chicken nor their eggs as a result of his religion, though his wife of Chinese descent and his baby boy Simon do. The Mirror goes on to tell us that Stan cannot practice the proper ritual in England, for to do that, he would need a loincloth while bowing before the bird, and the bird should be ornamented with red beads and a red cloth around its neck, and he doesn't feel comfortable that that would be okay. But he does what he can, and Stan reports that, quote, here in England, when the full moon comes, I just sit and think of chicken worshipping back home in the jungle. It's all right here in my heart.
Stan. Do any pictures exist of Stan?
There is, and it will be in the show notes. I love this history site. And yes, Stan was there. And I also love because on that site, it's full of these rich and colorful tidbits of people that we otherwise might not have known. A commenter on this particular article, a person calling themselves Jojo, said, wow, I know this man. I'm so proud that I was able to bask in his greatness, a true legend and pioneer of Black Britons representing the jungle. Smiley face emoji. This is what I love about just exploring and taking in an area, whether it's virtually like we're doing or in real life, by just hopping on the tube and wandering. You learn about people like Stan Fraser. These are the people people tell you about in the pub.
Well, it's symbolic that, you know, he became a Londoner, but brought his culture with him. And now we get to hear about it and these other people that he left his mark on, clearly in this neighborhood.
Yes, he's a true pioneer to his peers, yet he's largely ignored by history for a multitude of reasons. Because, yes, he's a chicken worshiper, but he's also just an everyday taxi driver, one of many immigrants to a city that's full of them. In a city as dense as London, nearly every tube station has stories like that. In addition, near almost every station, there's numerous landmarks, museums, gardens, homes of listed Londoners, wildlife areas, something related to the arts. I could go on. Oval is no different. It is a fairly dense residential area at its heart, but so much is within that 1 kilometer or a kilometer and a half of the station that if we wanted to take a nice walk, the Imperial War Museum is actually just about a mile away.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yes. The Cinema Museum is also there, as is the Tate Britain, which houses the permanent National Collection of British Paintings. So not to be confused with the Tate Modern.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Lovely.
The Lambeth Palace is also close. And I don't know if you're familiar with Lambeth Palace, but it's it is a heritage site that dates back to the 13th century. It was the London residence of the Archbishops of Canterbury.
That's all.
No big deal. NBD. Right. Just the Archbishops. Around 1200, Archbishop Robert Walther established monastic buildings as well as a private residence for himself. And those early buildings are at the core of Lambeth Palace. So the palace had a cryptid vault that's actually been ransacked numerous times, none recently. And its water tower that also served as an infamous prison. You can find those everywhere. There's a library there. I thought you might find this particularly interesting, Maris, that many consider the absolute best source of information on the history of the Church of England.
Yeah.
You can actually go there yourself. Like, you're there, you can go and access these ancient books. It has a historic great hall, a lovely garden.
Ooh.
You do have to make an appointment to have a guided tour, but it's not hard to do. Given this particular journey is a spontaneous journey, though, we're not going to go there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell you about it.
Plant
that little seed.
Noted and on my way.
Because we can walk by it. We could also go see the historic Jewel Tower, which was built in the mid-14th century to house King Edward III's treasures. It's not too shabby, but I'm just not in a palace mood today. Nor am I in a garden mood, even though the fabulous London Garden Museum is also in this area. I actually don't plan to go to a museum at all today, as much as you love them. Where I want to take you is the SOE Memorial. Are you familiar with that? Do you know what that is?
SOE.
Yes, capital. You're in for a treat because you're about to meet someone who's one of those people that we just love to meet on these little adventures. But before I tell you about her, let's learn a little bit about the SOE and why it's been given a memorial. So SOE is short for the Special Operations Executive.
Okay.
It was also known as Churchill's Secret Army. That was one nickname. Another is the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Ooh.
I loved that.
Badass.
Yes. And still others referred to it as the Baker Street Irregulars.
Uh-huh.
I loved those names.
Yes.
Few people at the time, very few, were aware of the SOE's existence. It was, to put it simply, a secret sabotage organization. And it was basically the merger of a few other groups within MI6 or SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, the War Office, and the Foreign Office.
Sure.
Essentially, when the war started, intelligence was spread very, very, very thinly. We're talking the Second World War. And the SOE was organized to basically avoid duplication and overlap and a waste of resources because there weren't many to be had. It was formed to sort of consolidate some of the most super intense spying. The organization was formally created on the 22nd of July, 1940. Hugh Dalton, the Minister of Economic Warfare, was appointed to take political responsibility for this new organization. And he wrote in his diary on that day that the war cabinet agreed to his new duties that Churchill had told him, "And now go set Europe ablaze." Dalton actually, as he was building the SOE, used the IRA, the Irish Republican Army,
really?
That as his model for the organization. Interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There were branches of this department, of the SOE, all throughout the British Empire.
Is that right?
In India, all throughout Europe, even in places like New York City, there was a branch of the SOE. Throughout the war, the leader... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, was it, I mean, very, very secretive?
Very secretive.
Okay. Uh-huh. I seem to remember something about, like, the women spies that parachuted into France and all that.
Oh, Mares, you were in for a treat.
Bring it.
Listeners, that was some foreshadowing. I love it. Yes, you are absolutely right. You are such a smart one, and I love it, Mares. Yes, throughout the war, the leadership and organization at the SOE changed based on resources and necessities, as did its aims and purposes. But essentially, its number one purpose was to sabotage and subvert the Axis war machines through indirect methods. So think in today terms about the Russian internet bots, things that are meant to create some chaos, but on the down low, they're sneaky. They're twisting the knife in a way that you're not really noticing as much. Mm-hmm. The SOE operated actively, primarily within Axis-occupied territories. And their main objective was try to foment mutual hatred between the people that were the naturalized citizens of these occupied territories mm-hmm. and the occupiers. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to force the Axis to, you know, expend manpower and resources on just trying to maintaining control of these angry populations. Mm-hmm. So they're instigating, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're also trying to gain intelligence and really disrupt the spy chains, or excuse mm-hmm. me, the supply chains okay. of both the Germans and the Japanese mm-hmm. and the Italians.
So we're thinking mostly propaganda?
A lot of propaganda.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You hinted at this. I'm going to show you a picture of the SOE Memorial. And here it is. And listeners, you can, again, take a look in the show notes. This is the SOE Memorial. And you might notice that the bust is of a female. Mm-mm. So that is what the actual memorial looks like right there. It is a female. Her name is Violet Szabo. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing her name correctly. It's Violet spelled the French way, V-I-O-L-E-T-T-E.
Okay.
And her last name is spelled S-Z-A-B-O. Mm-hmm. Violet Szabo. I'm going to use the Anglicanized pronunciation of Violet. I'd like to tell you about her, especially because she's a Cockney with her roots in Brixton. So she's from...
Nice.
Yes. She's from Oval. And now she's on the bust that's at the memorial. Violet was born in 1921. Her mother was French and her father was English. She was the second of five children, but she was the only girl amongst them. So she had four brothers. During the Depression of the 1930s, Violet was sent off to live with her mother's family in France, which actually caused her to temporarily forget English. She lost it. It was reminding me, you know, we've talked often on the podcast about children being shipped to the countryside during the Second World War. We've mentioned it before, but I hadn't thought about it in depth that, you know, maybe just the decade before this was happening to kids during the Depression.
Right.
And it's repeating again. And this had been not long after the First World War. So
it's
just
incredible.
Unrest after unrest after unrest. Mm-hmm. But it was basically, they have five kids. They were having a hard time caring for each of them. So she went off to France for a little bit. They kind of spread out so that all the children could be well cared for. When she returned to England and went to school in Brixton, she got her English back very quickly. It was like her brain was awakened. But she remained bilingual the rest of her life, and that's important to remember. We'll come back to that. She was a very affable, very popular girl. And after her schooling ended, she worked in various retail clothiers, the Woolworths and Oxford Circus, and she worked at a place called Le Bon Marche in Brixton was another. So, like many other Britons, when the Second World War starts in 1940, and she's a young woman, she was born in 1921, so she's just 19, she immediately says, I'm joining the war effort, of course, and she chooses to join the Women's Land Army.
Okay.
Remember, she grew up with four brothers. She was a very active, by all accounts, very physical person, good athlete, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. And after she joined the Women's Land Army, she was initially sent to go pick strawberries in Hampshire.
Yep. Land girl.
She was bored. This wasn't for Violet. But as things heated up, she eventually was sent to an armaments factory in Acton. It was kind of recognized that she might be a good person to go to somewhere with a little bit more action. It was around that time that she met Etienne Szabo, which I thought was such a fascinating name. It's kind of French, and his last name is actually Hungarian.
Hungarian, yeah.
So he was a non-commissioned officer in the British Army of Hungarian descent, and they met, this is so wartime, after a whirlwind 42-day romance. Not uncommon. He was 31. She was still just 19, just finished school. They had a week-long honeymoon before he was sent to Liverpool and then on to Senegal, followed by South Africa, then Eritrea and Syria. During a leave he had in 1941, he came home to Britain, and she became pregnant and gave birth to their daughter, Tanya. He was already gone. He hadn't seen his daughter yet. She was pregnant, found out she was pregnant after he had already left. While Etienne was abroad, Violet took a job as a switchboard operator for the general post office. Just like when she was picking strawberries, though, she was bored to tears. So Violet, not being one to let grass grow under her feet, keep in mind, she just had a child a few months ago. She enlisted in the Auxiliary Territorial Service, or ATS, on the 11th of September, 1941. Mm-hmm. They sent her up to Leicester for initial training before being sent to be one of the first mixed anti-aircraft batteries of the 7th Heavy Anti-Aircraft Training Regiment, Royal Artillery, in Oswestry, Shropshire. Okay. Shropshire, for specialized instruction. Yes. So she's working in anti-aircraft batteries. Uh-huh. She's working in actually operating weapons.
Yeah.
She did pretty well and became a gunner. She had further training in Anglesey, and Gunner Zabo and her unit were eventually posted in Cheshire near Warrington from December 1941 to February 1942. And I misspoke earlier. She hadn't had the child yet. She was pregnant in 1941.
Gotcha, yes.
It's around this time that she finds out, when her husband had been there on leave, she was pregnant. So this is when she realizes that she's pregnant, and she returns to London for her daughter's birth. And Tanya is her name. Tanya Damaris Desiree Zabo was actually born in 1942.
Okay.
My apologies. Born on the 8th of June, 1942. So she takes a few weeks to heal. But she was on a mission, because like many women of the time, she felt that inner calling. And she wanted to be with her child, but she also felt that her child wouldn't have a world to live in if she didn't get back to work and get back to her calling. So she did. She felt like it was what she had to do. Like many other women at the time, she sent her baby to childminders while she was working at an aircraft factory in South Morden. While she was working there, and you might have guessed this was coming, tragedy strikes. Just 4.5 months after the birth of Tanya, Etienne Zabo was killed, never to meet his child or see his wife again. As I was reading the story and reading about them and seeing, you know, Etienne's journey through all these different countries, I could think, oh, he still made it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, now he's here. Oh, he still made it.
Yeah.
Oh, now he's on leave. Oh, now he's going here. Well, he didn't make it. It was Etienne's death that really motivated Violet to accept the invitation that came her way soon after that to join the SOE. How and why Violet was invited to join the SOE, I wish I could tell you, but no one really knows, at least that I could find out, or the people that do know don't want us to know.
Sure.
Or they made sure that nobody would find out in the future. It's a bit of a mystery.
Of course.
Her file has been mostly blacked out, or it's disappeared. It's very, very thin. It just doesn't exist. And this is the case with many of the recruits of the SOE.
They're spies. Yeah, that makes sense.
They're not for nosy little pokers like us to dig into.
Yeah.
But we can kind of surmise that it's her outgoing nature combined with her military experience, the fact that she was fluently bilingual.
Oh, that's huge. Yeah.
Played a big role. And they really needed agents in occupied France. That was one of the places.
I mean, it doesn't seem, you know, preposterous to think that they might put the word out, like, keep an eye out for us. If you see any real potential, just send them our way. You know, we could have conversations. I mean, that makes perfect sense that they would have kind of headhunters out there in the field.
And she's a gunner.
Right.
I mean,
she's got a pretty specific skill set there for a 19 or 20-year-old.
Well, and she also seemed extremely brash and very determined. And she also has that emotional trigger now with the loss of her husband, and now her daughter doesn't have a father.
Yes.
And that really, you know, we all react differently to tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Violet wasn't one to react by curling up. Violet wanted to take action. And however one reacts, there's, you know, reasons and, mm-hmm. and positives and negatives. But this mm-hmm. this was her reaction. So she's sent off to training, and the training is intense. She went through several different camps. And again, a lot of what she went through during the training process, I don't know. I wish I could. It's like when we've done our episodes on the MI6 spies, we don't know all the details of it. Mm-hmm. But we do know that it was pretty intense because she didn't go on her first mission until 1944. So she was in training for quite a while.
Yay for yes. training.
So she's sent to France in 1944, where she acted as a courier in a resistance group that had been uncovered by the Gestapo. So Violet's job was to try and reestablish contact with the members of this network and gather vital intelligence. Let's just,
wow.
Can we just imagine you're in occupied France?
Yeah.
And people like Violet, who are bilingual, and remember, her mother was French. She was able to blend in a little bit more, so she didn't stick out necessarily as being English. It also seemed as if they were given training similar to the KGB working with accents so that she might pass at least as a local. And I think that was another reason why the training was so long. And she had been fluent in French since the beginning, so she probably could pull off a very good accent, I would think. So that was her first mission. Her second mission began on the 7th of June in 1944, the day after D-Day. She and two other agents parachuted, just like you said, into the southwest of France to set up a new network with local resistance groups. Can you imagine? She has a, three-year-old? Not even a three-year-old, because her child was about a three-year-old, very close to her kid's birthday.
Yeah.
Her kid is one day shy of being three. She's lost her husband. Mm-hmm. She's jumping from a plane, landing in France, with the job that she has to go organize resistant groups against Nazis.
I'm assuming this is all happening in the dead of night, too. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, they would have to, right?
Yes.
There's somebody parachuting to Earth. Like, how easily could your cover be blown?
And, you know, I was thinking about this as I'm picturing her jumping from this plane. It's often talked about, and of course it's talked about, and it should be. You know, you think of Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, all these names of the Allies in the Second World War. But look at all these women and figures we've uncovered. Look at Lee Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Look at Violet.
Right.
Look at Dr. Joan.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all the people on the home front, you know, as this is happening.
Yeah.
So that's her job. And after she lands, 3 days after they had parachuted in, Violet was on a courier trip with one of the resistant leaders who was known as Anastasie. Looks like Anastasia, but French, I'm assuming, when they encountered German forces. Their car was stopped at a roadblock and a gun battle takes place. Violet is captured. And while she's being captured, she maneuvers it and takes the attention away from her captors so that Anastasie can escape and does to freedom. So she sacrifices herself for her friend. After capture, Violet is brutally interrogated in a prison in Paris before being deported by train to Germany. During the journey, the train was attacked by British aircraft, ironically, and Violet and another female prisoner took the opportunity at a great personal risk to take water to the male prisoners who were suffering. So as the distraction, they see this as their opportunity to go help the other prisoners. Amazing. When she did that, though, it was at great cost. It angered her captors. She was captured and held and likely tortured. When they arrived in Germany, she was taken to Ravensbrück concentration camp in early 1945, and sadly, she was executed. Posthumously, Victoria Szabo was awarded the George Cross for bravery on the 28th of January, 1947, and her daughter is the one who accepted the award for her. And I'm going to put on our website a picture of little Tania taking the award for her mom. And it's right here. You see it? And it's so cute. She's wearing a sweet little dress, and they're bending it down. I know. Isn't that just... It gives you kind of the... At JFK's funeral with little John kind of vibes. Yeah. Just a sweet little girl. So the memorial that's here near Roval has a granite plinth atop a square base with a bust of our Violet atop the plinth. There's a large plaque on the west side of the plinth, and then smaller plaques on the north and south flanks of it. Mm-hmm. There's an additional small plaque on the base. I'd like to read you just two of these plaques, if that's okay.
Now this, you said this is an SOE memorial, not necessarily a Violet.
Well, it's sort of both.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Because it is a memorial to the SOE as a collective. It's honoring their presence, and the plaques will reflect that. Mm-hmm. But she is the representative. She's the bust, and she's the symbol of it that they chose to put atop. So it's really sort of serving a double purpose. So the large plaque reads, SOE, the Special Operations Executive, was secretly formed for the purpose of recruiting agents, men and women of many nationalities, who would volunteer to continue the fight for freedom by performing acts of sabotage in countries occupied by the enemy during the Second World War. This monument is in honor of all the courageous SOE agents, those who did survive and those who did not survive their perilous missions. Their services were beyond the call of duty in the pages of history. Their names are carved with pride. On the south side is a dedication to the fighters of the Maquis and to Violet Szabo in these words. The Maquis, French resistance fighters. 470 SOE agents were sent on sabotage missions to occupied France, where they fought with networks of French resistance fighters who played an important part in the liberation of France in 1944. Violet Szabo, 1921 to 1945, whose sculpture is on this plinth and who was posthumously awarded the George Cross and the Croix de Guerre, was among the 117 SOE agents who did not survive their missions to France.
How many again did not survive?
117. Whew. Yeah. So that is that was our little journey.
Yeah.
Today,
yeah.
So much going on in Lambeth and Oval, so representative of this city. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just leave us there. It's a bit sobering. It's important, but it's sobering.
Yes.
I think as always, though, you're ready for a little bite to eat, and that's what I like to do whenever I find a new station.
Yes.
And before we leave, I thought we'd catch a bite. I want to give a shout out to the place that, if I was there in real life, where I'd be going, and it's called the Duchy Arms. So I'm going to show you a picture of it. Here's the inside. And again, listeners, please go to the show notes.
Of course.
They're known for their Sunday roast. And there's the outside.
Oh, yeah.
I also included a picture, and this will be in the show notes as well, of it at nighttime because it's probably getting to be evening. And look at it just glowing like a beacon, Mares. Mm. It's calling us. It's two stories with bricks and the lights shining warmly between each arched window on the bottom. Oh. Just lovely. And there's a picture of the Sunday roast. Mm-hmm. Look at that Yorkshire pudding.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that pint and the picnic tables we talked about. So we'll end it at the Duchy. I highly recommend if you take one of these trips that you look. This one's extremely close to Oval Station. The next time in London, I plan to go find it. And I want to go pay my respects to our Violet. Aww. And as I walk there, I'm going to think of Stan, the chicken worshiper. Yeah. I'm going to think about that first night of the Blitz. I'm going to think about all the everyday heroes who walk at every station in this city we love so much.
Thank you so much for introducing us to Violet and her cohorts, and all the heroes, as well as this amazing section of the city.
Well, Lambeth. I hope that you're not too tired, because I think I've got another journey in me coming up soon. So,
who knows where we'll
you
land.
And the listeners, if you want to, maybe we'll land in another place in the next episode.
Spin that wheel, my friend.
Listeners, tell us, give us some feedback. Let us know if you've been to Oval, or if you've explored on the tube, where are your favorite destinations? Where would you like to see us go on yesterday's London Times? Is there a station that you think we should explore on air? We would love to have your suggestions. You can feel free to email us at yesterdayslondontimes@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Yesterday's London Times Podcast. We're still sometimes on Twitter at YLT_pod. You can find us on TikTok at YLTpod. Is that what we are on? TikTok? I've got to look it up. Find it.
Go to our
It'll be
show
on the
notes.
Show notes.
It's all there.
I can't keep all of our socials
straight.
That's
a lot.
And we've got the blog. I am going to add this to our blog. I want to keep sort of a travel log in our blog so that we can see where we go this year and sort of make a photo album of memories of
Lovely.
Every place we've been. So we'll have links to all of our socials, to the blog, our emails there. Please communicate with us. We loved hearing your reactions to our previous episode about Barbara, and we can't wait to hear what you think about Oval and where you want to explore with us in the future.
Thanks again, Jen. It's great.
Thanks, Mares. Thanks for listening and thinking along with us. We hope you enjoyed this segment of our journey.
Our music is from the album Astral Gate, used with permission of the artists Lucas Perny and Miroslav Kolar. Audio mixing by DJ Kensington.